It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll find out why big banks have such a hard time saying sorry for bad behavior and why that matters.
But first, on Friday, a federal appeals court reinstated Wisconsin's voter ID law less than 8 weeks before the November 4th midterm elections.
Last April, a federal judge issued a stay on the law saying it would disenfranchise thousands of eligible voters. However, the Republican-controlled legislature said the law is needed to help stop voter fraud.
Joining us now is J.R. Ross, editor at WisPolitics.com. Welcome to Central Time, JR.
Thank you. How are you guys doing today?
Pretty good, thanks. So we had a very swift decision last week, about 5 hours of oral arguments and a decision dropping Friday night. So it was pretty quick. How unusual is it to get a decision like this so close to the November election?
Just to have a decision that quickly in anything is pretty unusual. In the cases that I've covered with the appeals court, the only thing that comes close was a case involving a state employee you might remember was convicted of a bid rigging scheme under Governor Doyle. The appeals court said that morning in arguments that the evidence was beyond thin, had a decision to have a release by that afternoon. That's the only thing I can think of that comes close to this in the speed in which the court acted. Usually it's days or weeks before there's a decision come down.
Now, the court had asked whether Wisconsin was ready to implement this law. The argument or the answer there from the state was, yes, we are. What do you think about that, the readiness of Wisconsin at this point?
Well, they're scrambling a little bit. I mean, you just talk to some local clerks today. They're talking about things like needing to hire more workers for the polling places on election day, needing to increase dramatically the amount of training that they do because they do these sessions every October to kind of make sure folks remember the procedures, what you have to do. Remember, you have to sign a poll book when you go to the polling place now, things like that. Now they have to add in this other request, what forms of ID are acceptable, how you have to approach this, just to make sure people know what to expect. If you remember, we've only had one election that this requirement was in place for. That was the February 2011 primary. Low turnout rates, not a whole lot of action. So we're not really familiar with it as in terms of election workers in Wisconsin. They're not fully, haven't had a good trial run, if you will, in a long time in how this is going to operate.
Reporters have said from the Journal Sentinel that there are some 12,000-ish ballots, absentee ballots, that have already been sent out. Is there any word from the state about how it will deal with that, given that they don't include any instructions about how to vote with the new voter ID law?
Not yet. Government Accountability Board officials were meeting, actually started about an hour ago, to kind of start going over those issues. What do we do? And they hope to have media availability tomorrow to explain to us what they're trying to do. Also hope to have advice sent to clerks by tomorrow to tell them what they should be doing. You know, I talked to the Madison City clerk today. She said they had 3,000 ballots ready to go. They hadn't sent them out yet because they're due on Thursday. Now they're wondering, they're getting calls from people saying, okay, look, I sent your request for an absentee ballot before. Do I have to send a new one? Because I didn't have, with this new decision in place, like, what do I have to do? In other places, if you sent them out, is that ballot still going to be good? Do you have to send a new one? Do you just send them follow-up directions? What do you have to do to comply with this law? It could be a little bit sticky for some of those ballots to make sure it all works out correctly.
Now, I understand that the panel made this decision on the grounds, partially at least, that there is a new mechanism in place in Wisconsin for citizens to get an ID without paying anything. Do we know what that system is so far, how it works? What do we know about it?
The Walker administration has kind of outlined how this will work. Now, remember, we had different cases challenging the voter ID law. One was in state courts, and the state Supreme Court essentially ordered Wisconsin to make this fix, if you will, to make the law constitutional in their eyes. So what you have to do, if you don't have a birth certificate, which is what's needed to get a driver's license normally, you can show other birth information to officials. So they can then take your name and run them through databases to find records of your birth. That could be things like baptismal records, school records, other things for those who never got a birth certificate. Then they can, it's a waiver process essentially to say, okay, you don't have this normally required form. We'll do this for you for free. Then you'll have the documentation you need to get the free ID. Now, it still could be somewhat time consuming, and there's another concern for some folks of how's that going to work? How long will it take to get an ID from the day you walk in the door with your other forms of identification until you walk out with ID in hand?
Do we know anything about whether or not there'll be an appeal?
Always possible. They could go out to court with a number of things. I mean, that question we just talked about, how much time will it take between you when you walking the documents, giving your ID, is that an issue? Is it an issue for those 11,800 ballots that have already been sent out? It's hard to say for sure, but you're in a narrow window. One thing that the Seventh Circuit said on Friday was they didn't decide the merits of the case in general, but what they did say was it is extremely likely that the state will prevail in its appeal of the decision by Judge Adelman to overturn the law. So it shows you that that three-judge panel is very much inclined at this point to say, no, that law is valid. And what one of the reasons they're saying that is because it is very closely related to the Indiana law, which the U.S. Supreme Court has already upheld.
Now, this was heard by a three-judge panel. Is there any chance that this could be heard from a bigger group of people from the appeals court?
They can always make that request. The court doesn't have to accept it or do it. So that's the other thing. This court was unanimous in saying, look, this is just like the Indiana law. It's already passed the U.S. Supreme Court, so what's different here? They're a little bit critical of Judge Adelman for deciding that this law is unconstitutional because of those parallels to one case that's already been before the U.S. Supreme Court.
So these laws have already, well, a couple of other voter ID laws have been passed, have stood up in court. Can we learn anything from those states about how it may have been implemented so far?
You know, possibly. That's what the GEB is trying to figure out right now. Like, what are they going to do? And remember, we kind of went through this process back in 2011 once that law was passed and passed quickly when Republicans took over control and in place for the February election. They did some dry runs there. Of course, the big issue back then and what election officials have said since then was they need time, to educate voters about what they need. Most of us do have an ID, and you know it's not that hard to pull it out of your wallet or your purse when you go vote. But in that case, that decision that Judge Adelman laid down, he knew there were about 300,000 people who didn't have that kind of identification. What happens to those folks? How do you get them? It also becomes incumbent upon the parties, campaigns to try and find their voters, their supporters, who may don't have an ID and make sure they get one, or what can they do to help those guys get to the polls, get their ID first, get to the polls on that Tuesday the 4th. So those are things they're kind of working through right now.
Now, the judges in their order said that recent changes made to the law by the Wisconsin Supreme Court reduced the likelihood of irreparable injury. Is that specifically in regards to the IDs, or are there other instances of injury that we're looking at addressing here?
That's specifically about the fix the state Supreme Court required. If you go back to those oral arguments for the state Supreme Court a few months back, Justice Pat Rogenczak really raised a concern that the process that had been in place before where you had to pay for your birth certificate amounted to a poll tax. So what she crafted in this decision was a way to address that issue. So she's saying, look, you can't require people to pay the government a fee to vote. By requiring them to pay for their birth certificate, you're doing that. This is a waiver process to get your documentation for free, to get your ID for free, to be able to vote. It addressed that poll tax issue that she kind of raised in oral arguments.
All right, we'll leave it there, JR. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That was JR Ross, editor at wispolitics.com. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Well, it's fair to say that over the last decade, some banks and financial institutions have engaged in some less than ethical behavior, in some cases, broken the law. Many of these institutions have had to pay up for their actions, and a lot of the cases, though, there's one thing they didn't have to do, admit any wrongdoing.
Our next guest says the state of bank apologies is a sorry one, and while public statements of contrition may be few and far between, he says they can actually be quite useful when they do happen.
Joining us now is Jesse Eisinger. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. He also writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why does it seem to be difficult to squeeze an apology out of a financial institution when they done wrong?
Well, this started in the 1970s with the SEC as they turned to trying to sanction larger companies. They wanted to kind of smooth things over, so they wanted to reach settlements, and they thought that they could reach settlements that really were effective and do a lot more of them if they didn't require people to plead guilty and take people to trials, civil trials, because the SEC doesn't have criminal power. And so they started settling with companies. And then the people would go out and say, well, I just settled this for because it was a nuisance settlement, but I didn't do anything wrong. So then they said, okay, well, we're going to have you not be able to deny this. So we call them no admit, no deny settlement. And this kind of happened, and the SEC felt like this was going okay, but it became the kind of default settlement. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice, skipping forward to the early 2000s, started sort of similarly thinking, well, we can't take everybody to trial. We can't sanction companies actual charges, because that could put them out of business, like Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm. So we're going to sort of take a page out of the SEC's book, and we're going to come up with deferred prosecutions. We're not going to actually prosecute. We'll just say we'll prosecute the next time that you make a mistake. And in combination, we got this situation where no one was ever admitting anything wrong. They were just sort of settling.
So they settle, the bank pays up money for, in a sense, undisclosed reasons if there's no admission of guilt, no prosecution.
Exactly. Frequently, there would be some statement of facts, but the statement of facts weren't particularly robust. Sometimes there weren't statements of facts at all. And so we got into this kind of habit of having them pay up, and the fines got bigger and bigger because this was the only thing that the SEC and the DOJ had going for them, the only sort of tool that they could use. But the fines really weren't particularly hard to take for these companies because it comes out of shareholder pockets. It doesn't come out of the executives' pockets personally. And so they were sort of paying with other people's money. Even though the fines were getting big, it wasn't really taking a bite out of them. And so when Mary Jo White came into the SEC about a year ago, she's the current chairwoman of the SEC, the commission, she decided, well, we got to stop this. We have to have some cases where people actually admit that they did something wrong. And simultaneously, the Department of Justice has decided, well, we can't have companies preventing them from pleading guilty at all. We have to have them plead guilty. So there's been this step forward in the last year or so where the Department of Justice is getting companies, mainly banks, now to plead guilty to certain things. And the SEC is getting mostly companies, but a couple of individuals to actually admit that they did something wrong. And so, you know, we have to consider this a major step forward in progress to actually have an admission that you did something wrong when you get fined. But that's what we have. And so we have to consider that some progress, not much.
Well, I guess what was the problem? If the bank or other financial institution pays a bunch of money, everybody knows they were being punished for something. Is it just a fine point of etiquette that they say, sorry, here's what we did wrong? Or is there a consequence to not getting that?
Well, I think that it's no good to have banks settling without admitting that they're doing something wrong, because even though they can't deny that they did something wrong, that they can't say, oh, I'm just doing a nuisance settlement, that most people sort of think, well, this could as well have been a nuisance settlement. So I think that it is important on occasion for banks that have done something wrong to have to admit that they've done something wrong. And then we get to other reasons why this is helpful and important. And as you said, we want to sort of lay out the facts and have the facts out there so everybody sees it. It's also a knock-on effect where this helps private litigants in their pursue their claims. So if there's a private litigant who is a victim of the bank's misbehavior, that entity can bring a case in court and use the facts as laid out and use the admission in court. It's not a guarantee that they'll get a settlement as well, or they'll get a penalty, they'll win their case, but it helps them. And what's happening now, though, is that the SEC and the DOJ are essentially tailoring their admissions to have little effect. They're very worried about the effects of these admissions, and so they're tailoring them so precisely as to make them anodyne, and that's no good. What we want, if they're going to go to the trouble of getting these guys to admit that they did something wrong, which is a good thing, then they should admit that they did something wrong and face the consequences.
Well, but isn't that part of the reason that the different federal entities you're talking about avoid this, that private litigant, that if the bank has to say, yes, I did this or we did this specific exact thing, that could open the floodgates to so many private lawsuits that it could threaten the well-being of a financial institution, which could threaten the well-being of our economy?
Yes, they're very worried about that, probably overly worried about it. It's not necessarily the case that the floodgates would be open so dramatically that they would it would necessarily threaten the business. But on the other hand, if a company has really done something very bad, then maybe that business shouldn't exist or should face some serious consequences, should face consequences commensurate with its bad actions. That's the only way I think we'll be able to get companies to act properly is if they see that the consequences are really significant. Now, there is some worry that the financial system could teeter on the brink of some kind of systemic failure if companies were going out of business. I'm sort of skeptical about that. But if they're worried about that, they can move to protect other companies. You could lend to other companies that weren't sanctioned, other banks, keep the lending windows open like that for other banks, and so that if you had Bank X that is really in trouble, banks Y and Z will continue to be able to operate. So I think they can. That it's not really the Department of Justice's job or the SEC's job to worry about the systemic fragility or stability of the financial system. If the cost of that is to let wrongdoers go free and recidivist law-breaking banks to continue to exist, I think that's too high a cost.
So you think there could be a scarlet letter effect if Bank X has made that apology? We know they are a wrongdoer. Bank Y hasn't had to do that. They've been more up and up. That might help the average investor or depositor or what have you select and reward good behavior?
Well, I think that that's possible if the consequences are significant enough for the banks. For instance, the head bank regulator in the state of New York, Benjamin Losky, now is kind of playing around with actual business consequences to bad actions. So the French bank BNP Paribas was charged with money laundering, and they weren't allowed to clear dollars, which is a kind of technical thing of allowing customers to use dollars in their transactions. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, is that there should be some business consequences so that you have to go to your clients and customers and say, well, we're actually not allowed to do this service because we're in the penalty box for this. We can't do an IPO, for instance, or we can't do any merger advisory for 6 months or a year. And that would have a kind of temporary effect, which would hit their bottom line, and that would also have a kind of lasting effect on their reputation, because people would remember, oh, I went to these guys and asked them to do something, and they couldn't do it, and the reason why was that they had done something bad in the past. Now what happens is when they pay these fines, that it draws a line under the scandal, it finishes it up, there's nothing left of it, and customers and shareholders buy the stock and come back and do business with them because the cloud is lifted. That's not really what we want from a punishment, is to have it completely resolved and the reputation cleaned.
Well, you mentioned that just in the last year you've seen examples of more accountability, more specific admissions of guilt. Are those exceptions, or do you think they're the wave of the future?
Well, I think what's happening now is that the Department of Justice and the SEC are both waking up to the realization that they've been pretty toothless. And so we are getting these baby steps towards some accountability. But they're still clearly afraid of overstepping and having punishments that are too consequential. When we saw Credit Suisse, which helped clients evade American taxes, when they admitted to that, there weren't really any business consequences. In fact, what happened was the Department of Justice went around to all the financial regulators and kind of begged them to not take any action against Credit Suisse, not to withdraw their bank charter or something like that. So what the DOJ essentially did was get Credit Suisse to admit it had done something wrong, but designed it in such a way to have no further consequences for that. So what's the difference between that and a settlement? Not much, basically just semantic. So what we want to do, I think, is have punishments that fit the crime, so they're not excessive, but also have some consequences. It's not an easy task.
Jesse, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Jesse Eisinger. He's a senior reporter at ProPublica. We're talking about his latest column, The Sorry State of Bank Apologies. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, police forces on some Wisconsin campuses are offering students who've been caught with drugs the opportunity to become police informants and avoid a felony. We'll hear from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
First, the effects of video games and technology on kids have been in the news a lot lately. A new study from UCLA found that kids who spent too much time on devices had trouble recognizing human emotions. And this weekend, the New York Times ran an article revealing that high-tech wizards like Steve Jobs were pretty hard-nosed when it came to screen time for their kids. Parents today, they're navigating new waters as they balance the latest research on technology and learning with the tech-saturated world we live in.
Joining us now to talk about parenting in the age of technology are Constance Steinkuhler and Kurt Squire. They're co-directors of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery at UW-Madison. Constance, welcome to Central Time. Constance, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having us.
Great. And Kurt, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I want to start out a little bit with this research from UCLA. This came out last week, saying essentially that kids who spend too much time on devices are less capable of recognizing emotions. Constance, what do you make of that finding?
Well, it's certainly an interesting finding, and it's coming out of a great lab. I mean, I think that right now, you know, we really know so little about children and devices. I mean, some of the work that we do is actually looking at how can games and other kinds of digital media be used to do exactly the opposite, to actually improve people's ability to recognize and engage with other people's emotional states? So the biggest question I have is simply, you know, rather than talking about screen time, we need to sort of dig into what are kids actually doing on media. Not all forms of media consumption are the same, and most parents know that.
So when we talk about different kinds of media consumption, can you put them on the spectrum for us in terms of ones that might be less worrisome and ones that might raise more of a flag?
Sure. I know, you know, and again, I think that most parents know their children and know when they start becoming uncomfortable with a certain kind of media pattern. In our own house, we have a basic rule of thumb that when media gets in the way of engaging in other activities that our kids are interested in, so, for example, if our kids are giving up, you know, dinner with their family or, you know, playing soccer with their friends outdoors, and to the detriment of those other habits, if they're engaged in media, then we sort of start to curtail the media down. And that's a pretty across-the-board rule of thumb when it comes to scholars that look at issues like addiction.
And Kurt, I want to talk to you next. You both have devoted your professional lives to learning about the potential of video games and developing that. But there is a seesawing of public opinion about devices like video games and iPads and how they might affect kids. Kurt, why is there so much anxiety right now about digital media, video games, technology, and parenting?
Sure. Well, typically any kind of new or emerging technology brings with it that same kind of fear and concerns, and then also hopes and dreams. So everything from, you know, the printing press to the telephone, the telegraph, has a very similar set of concerns around it. So it's something that is common, you know, the, video games, the internet, social media, and so on. They oftentimes are kind of a lightning rod for our social anxieties, but then also our hopes for how we might create a better future.
And ultimately, parents, you know, we can't really opt out of this. There's media everywhere. There's technology everywhere. Kirk, can you recommend any starting blocks for parents who want to start considering these questions about what's good for their kids and how much is too much?
Well, I think it's really good to, I personally advocate knowing your child, and every child is different, and trying to I guess, like Constance said, observe what they're doing and see when it's looking like it's something that's productive for them and healthy for their lives, and maybe when it's too much. One of the things that any parent can do that is almost always a good thing is try to figure out exactly what it is your children are interested in and what kinds of media they're consuming, and then having conversations with them about it, like what they like, what they don't like, what you can, you know, do dramatic play around it, depending on the age. There's all kinds of things you can do, but really getting into a conversation about the media they're consuming or interacting with is always a good thing.
And Constance, there's been, in the past decade or so, a lot of negative attention toward video games, in particular when it comes to school shootings. Is that something you think that we've sort of reached a cultural resting point on, that we're not as worried about that connection, or is it still something that's an active worry in our culture?
Well, I certainly think that parents and teachers are still concerned about the content and the messages that are in media. But I do think that we've kind of evolved a bit in our conversation around video games in particular. I think the fact that now games are so ubiquitous, they're across mobile devices, and your mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers, everyone kind of plays. So now that we have a more, I suppose, experienced consumer base, I think that, you know, sort of huge generalizations about games no longer fly. You know, in the past, when there was an episode of teen violence or a school violence, you know, very quickly it would be followed up with studies, you know, arguing, or reporters arguing, I should say, that that it's linked to video game violence, and that ultimately, you know, the perpetrators were video game players. But it's really important to remember that for most youth, most youth are video game players. 99% of boys, 94% of girls,
wow.
So 97% of youth across the board. Now, again, that doesn't mean to advocate, you know, even for games. And I would say in our house we regulate television and movie time far more than we regulate game time, because games are the one medium that can really turn screen time into activity time. You know, it's not a consumptive media. It's a media that doesn't do anything until you make a decision or move or act.
I guess I shouldn't be, but I'm a little surprised at those numbers. 99% of boys, 94% of girls. So I guess, you know, if you try to implicate video games in violence, it's like saying, you know, kids who breathe oxygen are more violent because everyone's doing it.
Exactly.
I want to ask you guys about a recent New York Times article. It came out this weekend saying that Steve Jobs and other tech leaders actually pretty stringent when it comes to allowing technology in their own homes. You might sort of think the opposite, but the takeaway there for parents reading that is kind of, you know, if Steve Jobs, you know, hardly allows any screen time in his home, what does he know that the rest of us don't know? What do you think tech leaders, according to this art, why do you think they come down on the side of caution, Kurt?
Well, I don't know. It's an interesting question. I did get a chance to read it, and I think there are at least a couple of themes that jump out at you that they, you know, made a really strong point of having dinner together as a family, which, and given the other things I've heard about Steve Jobs' life and work habits, I'm impressed that he did actually make the time, but because not all families can. I don't know how well he could do with that, but it's a kind of thing that if you can find a way to do it, I know it's difficult for many families, but that's a very valuable thing, and there has been a lot of research around that as well as being a very kind of important form of social interaction. But I think that it hopefully it at least communicates if there's a sense that we, you know, have to get all of the latest devices or our kids will inherently fall behind. That clearly these tech leaders weren't saying that that's true. At the same time, I would be surprised if they didn't have access to things like computers for learning things like programming or design. And so I do want to, you know, I would also want to caution just to make sure that people don't, you know, think that they weren't living out, you know, entirely in the woods or something without any devices, because it does seem that most kind of tech leaders do support their kids' interests and use technology to develop those passions and to develop skills so that they can kind of learn on their own and learn to express themselves through a variety of means supported by technology.
Right, and there was someone quoted in the article, and I can't remember exactly who at the moment, but saying that you can actually spend time creating artistically online during screen time, and that's a legitimate, you know, kind of artistic creation time for kids. Do you think that's true, Constance?
Absolutely. I think one really important theme in the articles and the discussion is really that you have parents that are involved in making strategic choices around media. And, you know, in most of our lifestyles right now, we are absolutely awash with media as adults. So we're setting a model where, you know, computers and digital mobile devices are just integrated into every aspect of our life, both at home and at work. And I think one, I would say the theme that you see is that these are hands-on parents who actually have ideas about what's good and not good for their kids. You know, right now, the contemporary media landscape does not make those choices easy. I'll give you an example. My 7-year-old is extremely interested in football. He loves Madden. And for him, screen time is really caught up in this kind of ecosystem where he is watching live games with his father. He's playing football for fun with his little friends. He's playing Madden, and he uses Madden as a way to model through various real-time players. So it's really sophisticated kinds of work. But, you know, as a mom, I'm terrible at Madden. It's not very fun for me, and it's hard. If I weren't actually a game scholar, it would be very difficult for me to understand, is this productive media consumption? Is this creative and playful and thought-provoking and problem-solving, or is this button-mashing? And that's hard to do when you're dealing with media that are, you know, 50-hour games. But I think that the rule of thumb is probably engage with what your children are doing, and that we're not off the hook as parents to actually make some decisions around what is appropriate and what is not appropriate media use.
We're talking right now with Constance Steinkuhler and Kurt Squire. They're co-directors of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery at UW-Madison.
And we want to hear from you. Do you worry about parenting in the age of technology? What kinds of limits do you give your kids when it comes to screen time and video games? Do you see benefits to playing some of these games? And are you hopeful about some of the new research related to games and learning? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about technology and parenting right now with Constance Steinkuhler and Kurt Squire. They're co-directors of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery at UW-Madison.
And we want to hear from you. What kind of limits do you give your kids when it comes to screen time and video games? Do you see video games in particular as a negative, a positive, or maybe a little of both in kids' lives? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And I want to ask about, you know, the work that you both do pretty much every day. You're working on new applications for games and learning. Kurt, what are you excited about right now?
That's a good question. Well, one thing I'm excited about is one of our games called Econauts was just selected to be a part of the CoLab incubator out in San Francisco. So we just flew a graduate student out there and there's an article in Forbes on it, actually, who's going to be working to develop this, hopefully for a broader marketplace for homes and schools and after schools. We worked with Robert Bohannon over at UW's Limnology Department on it extensively. So it's got really good science behind it, and it's trying to make kind of the idea of how do we manage our environmental resources most effectively, kind of make it into an interesting game.
And so there's some fish in it, I take it. So it's called Econauts?
Econauts, yeah.
Econauts.
So there's fish and there's lumber. So you have to manage the very real demands of how do we use our, you know, lumber resources and mining and so on, but then also with kind of understand the various environmental effects of what gets done where and in what ways. And so one thing I like about it is that it tries to get beyond some of the kind of either-or debates or the kind of traditional political lines and says, well, look, we know we have to make decisions about how to use our resources kind of responsibly, and then it lets kids do this in a real-time strategy game that's a lot of fun.
Great. And let's go to the phones right now. Selena is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Selena.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I just had just something that really worried me. Recently, my two grandsons, 12 and 13, who I don't get to see very often, I made arrangements for them to come to my house and spend the night and then go to a water park and spend the night at that water park. And they had their two things that they have, like, constantly. One, I think, was an iPod, and then they had the other one had a game one of the game things that they were, you know, constantly playing, constantly on. They had these earbuds in their ears constantly, you know, and, you know, I don't see them often enough that I want to get, like, really, really strict with them since, you know, we were supposed to be having a good time. And so they spent, you know, the whole night with these things on, and then they wouldn't turn them off. I couldn't take them away from them. And they were supposed to go to sleep, and at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I went into the bedroom to check to make sure they were asleep, and they still had these things in their ears.
Wow, so they really were going at it with the iPods and other games. I don't know, do you guys, this isn't exactly your specialty about how to, you know, negotiate the territory with the kids themselves, but Constance, any advice that comes to mind?
Yeah, well, I sympathize. I've been in that situation with teens before, so I know what that pattern looks like. And it's tricky, right? I mean, you certainly, I feel for you in that you don't want to engage in a power struggle around it. But I do think it's okay as adults with children and with, you know, young teenagers that to simply say, you know, this isn't going to be a media time. I'm much more comfortable and liberal when it's something like, you know, the 25 minutes it takes me to get home from work where I know my child would be really probably sitting idle. I don't mind if he gets out his iPad then. But, you know, when it comes to sitting down to dinner last night, you know, all those devices have to go off, including my own, by the way.
Well, good luck, Selena. I hope you've got some ideas there. We're going to go next to Greg in Wausau. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I am a 22-year-old, and I've been around video games a lot, and I know sometimes they do have kind of a bad rap with violence. So I did want to say I think it's really good what we see going on with people trying to implement these new type of games where they are actually educational and they do help rather than just being about warfare. And second, I did just want to say, especially about the last caller that I just caught, I think that's really good to have that implemented with your family to have more connection and keep the eyes up at each other and conversation versus being sucked into an inanimate object like a phone. So I think it's really good with what we've been striving for in recent times.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your call, Greg. Appreciate that. And this is a good time, Constance, to ask you about some of the work that you've done in cooperation with the Center for the Investigation of Healthy Minds. Do you want to tell us about some of that?
Sure. Well, our center, the Games on the In Society Center, have been collaborating with Richie Davidson and his Center for Investigating Healthy Minds for probably the last year and a half or so. And part of what we're trying to do is to think about how would you actually create engaging experiences on screens that do exactly the opposite of what you're seeing the recent study report, where rather than disengaging people socially, it actually reengages them. You know, there are certain things that digital devices can afford us. And it's probably also worth reminding everyone that, you know, I'm in my 40s, and when I grew up in a small town where after school, you know, we were kind of latchkey kids after a certain point, but we all played in the yard and got to play outside with strangers, with neighbors, you know, until the pole lights came on. And that really is not the context for many youth right now. For many youth, they're time socializing without parents hovering over them is fairly limited. There's most of their pastimes where they're engaging with other kids outside of classrooms happens to be through structured activities like soccer or ballet. So what that means is that, you know, kids are playing online and they're playing through digital media devices and they're coming up with new forms of sort of less regulated, less parent-regulated worlds in which they can engage. And I don't, you know, I think it's hard to talk about youth culture without also acknowledging the history of where it's at. So part of the work we've been doing is thinking about, well, if kids are gaming on average about an hour and 20 minutes a day or so, what could we be creating in that space that would actually re-engage them in other kinds of activities that we know are going to be really life-enhancing?
And, yeah, that's part of it is getting them into the life-enhancing sorts of games. But I also wonder if part of what you guys are doing in the center is you're trying to get away from the old notion that if it's educational, it's a synonym for boring and getting kids who want to play this kind of video game instead of, you know, thinking, oh, it's educational, it's good for me, I don't want to play it. What do you think, Kurt?
Absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of what we try to do is try to find places where something like, say, new discoveries in science or maybe even, you know, aspects of history are inherently engaging and there's a game kind of to be found in it. So some of the work we did with, say, the systems biologists here at UW was looking at how they are, the kinds of research they're doing on viruses and trying to understand, say, the relationship between the different microbes in the body. It's really fascinating stuff. And then build games about it, because in that case, there really is this sort of game that's been going on between bacteria and viruses and, you know, various parasites and whatnot in the human body or, you know, mammals in general. And, say, building a game around that or something around stem cells that we've been doing to try to just find things that are interesting. And it's a little bit like the role historically that science fiction has played or historical fiction in terms of being about real things, letting you play around with some of the ideas.
Kurt, what would you say to sort of encourage parents that it's okay what's happening now? There is an explosion of digital media, an explosion of games, online stuff, and different platforms, but that it's okay and that, you know, everyone will get through it, you know, at least mostly unscathed.
Well, I think partly, you know, just remembering back to when they were kids or we were kids and you know, some of the crazy things that we did and, you know, most of us came out okay. And I think that that's always, you know, just a good kind of sobering thing to remember. I think the other thing is it's sometimes useful to look at yourself, too. So I sometimes, you know, laugh because my kids, both at the age of 2, learned to say, phone down, daddy, look at me. Oh, maybe I'm modeling this. And so, you know, just being aware that this is, you know, we are the most powerful role models and that we do live in a world that's awash with screens. And I think giving them the tools to try to manage that, and that does include, as, you know, Constance was saying, stepping in at times and helping them make decisions or making decisions. But, yeah, I think the vast majority of the research on it shows that it's, you know, in general, things are, you know, like I said, going to be okay, but that it is okay to kind of, you know, step in and follow what you think are the needs of your child.
And yeah, I know you guys are both not just in this professionally, you're in this for fun, too. You both love to play games. So in our final moments here, Constance, what are you playing right now?
Oh, my goodness. So I am playing Diablo 3 on hardcore mode with my husband, and it's the way that we stay in and play like we're having a date night after the kids are bed. It's super fun. It makes me laugh out loud. And I'm also playing a couple casual games on my phone. I'm playing Two Dots, which is, oh, has gotten so devilishly hard that, yeah, that I talk to it quite a bit.
Right. Two Dots and Diablo 3. What about you, Kurt?
Well, yes, the aforementioned Diablo 3. But then also Minecraft. My oldest child and I have a Minecraft server. We play with some people from work. And that's a lot of fun, just getting in it. And, you know, doing something kind of creative and exploratory together. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for joining us. That was Constance Steinkuhler and Kurt Squire, co-directors of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery at UW-Madison.